If you owe the bank $100, J. Paul Getty once said, it's your problem. You owe the bank $100 million? It's the bank's problem. You owe $169 billion? Could be everybody's problem. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 24th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin in corporate America today, where quarterly earnings reports have been the barometer the past couple of weeks. AT&T had its turn this morning. Did fine. Not quite as good as everybody had been guessing, but fine. The real story of AT&T, though, and an increasing number of businesses in this economy, is its giant pile of debt. The company promised last year it was going to do something about how much it owed, and it is trying to make good. It has lost hundreds of thousands of TV and wireless subscribers as it's moved money away from promotions into paying down that debt. But for dealing with debt for AT&T and others could be a problem down the road. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the story.
So AT&T owes $169 billion.
Their debt levels are really, really high. I mean, they have the most debt of any public U.S. company right now.
Keith Snyder is an industry analyst with CFRA. AT&T has a lot of stuff it needs to do, like get more content for HBO, develop a streaming service, roll out 5G networks. This is all expensive.
That debt load is acting as kind of financial handcuffs to them.
Why did it take on all this debt in the first place? Well, in part, because it could. Interest rates have been super low for a decade.
If you were a company and you can borrow at these very low rates and you have something to do with the money, you'd be kind of crazy not to do it.
Kenneth Rogoff is a professor of economics at Harvard. Corporate debt in general nearly doubled in the past 12 years, from less than $5 trillion to more than $9 trillion.
The problem is that some of the people borrowing are borrowing with very few restrictions. They're going down into much chunkier kinds of debt.
He says there could be one or even $2 trillion worth of this kind of debt out there. And it's mostly not companies like AT&T, whose debt is still investment grade. It's small and medium-sized companies.
It presents a risk, certainly, if and when we head into our next recession.
Carl Tannenbaum is chief economist at Northern Trust.
When you have lower rated corporate debt, what that means is that the distance between performance and default is that much shorter.
Depending on how intertwined in the broader financial system all this debt is, defaults could be destabilizing for the economy. Unfortunately, the best way to find out is for there to be another recession. For now, a recession in the next year seems unlikely. So debt-laden companies may have a little longer to clean up their books, but not forever. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Sure, Tesla gets all, or most anyway, of the electric vehicle buzz. But how about a startup called Rivian? It wants to bring the world's first all-electric pickup trucks to market. And today, Ford announced a $500 million investment in the company. Ford, as you might have heard, has been working on an electric F-150, the top-selling truck in America. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on the road to pickup electrification and what bumps may lie ahead.
If you drive a pickup, you don't care about bumps. What do you care about, according to truck commercials?
You want the most torque? You got it. You want the best towing? All yours. This is the big dog.
Power, utility, freedom, and apparently a lot of noise. That's the package you buy into with a pickup today. But can those selling points transfer over to a quiet plug-in electric truck?
I probably would never buy an electric truck.
I caught truck owner Freddie Richardson on his morning commute through Sacramento in his Dodge Ram. He's actually contemplated buying an EV for daily driving, but not for truck duties. He's worried about limited range, hauling equipment and towing trailers. Rivian estimates its pickup will go about 400 miles on a charge, but that starts dwindling with heavy loads.
That would be a pain in the butt, having to stop every 100 miles and charge your vehicle for 3 hours.
Guys like Richardson are probably not the target audience for the first generation of electric trucks, says Stephanie Brindley, an auto analyst with IHS Market.
Buyers will be sort of early adapters and interested in the technology for its sake.
But she says Ford has its eye on the long game, maybe 30 years down the road, when advances in battery technology and charging infrastructure could make EVs far more widespread and appealing.
This is going to happen.
In a press call earlier today, Ford CEO Jim Hackett touted the company's commitment to an electric future. Pickup truck sales have been on the rise, and Hackett believes Ford can translate those sales into the EV market.
But the tipping point approaches, and if you wait too long, you can't recover.
Until then, you might be more likely to see the vehicles used in commercial fleets with predictable routes, even though you might not hear them. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Two more quick things before we move on back on corporate profits. First of all, Boeing reported this morning a big miss relative to expectations because of its 737 MAX problems. More interesting, though, is that the company said its earlier predictions for its finances for the whole rest of the year are now no good. They'll let us know, they said, once they figure out how much the 737 MAX problems are going to cost them. Also, Facebook, they reported after the bell today, did fine, but also said inquiries into its privacy practices could cost the company up to $5 billion this year. We will have the details when we do the numbers. One hears the word Lululemon and one thinks yoga pants, yes? Women's yoga pants, to be specific? Well, if the company has its way, that is going to change. The athleisure clothing brand wants to make you think of comfy pants for men, too. Lululemon released its five-year growth plan today, aiming for annual revenue growth in the low teens. And one way it hopes to do that is by doubling sales of men's clothing. Marketplace's Mario Segarra looked into what it takes for a brand to become known for something more than just the products that made it famous.
Ben Garrison started rock climbing last year, and he was trying to figure out what he should wear. One day, he was at the gym in San Antonio with his wife, and he noticed another guy's pants.
I was like, those are the kinds of pants I want. Where do you think we get those? And she's like, oh, that's Lululemon. She knew it right away.
He was like, Lululemon? Really?
Even the name to me feels like a feminine name. Or a company.
Brands love to be known for something in particular. For Lululemon, it's women's yoga pants. For Harley Davidson, it's motorcycles for tough guys. Christina Durante teaches marketing at Rutgers.
If you have a strong brand identity, you're going to have people who are going to be loyal to your product because it aligns with their identity.
But a strong identity can also get a brand pigeonholed, especially when it comes to gender. Some men don't want to or wouldn't think to buy clothing from a brand they associate with women. Men's clothing reportedly makes up about 20% of Lululemon sales right now. To double that, Durante says Lululemon needs to broaden its identity.
It could be about, you know, very high-quality athletic apparel without simply being a product for moms who do yoga and go to, you know, soccer tournaments.
To do that, Lululemon is going to need more guys like the one Ben Garrison saw at the gym.
It was seeing someone else who was a guy doing an activity that I was already doing where I realized, oh, that's a product that exists for me.
But Garrison isn't telling his friends about his Lululemon pants. He thinks they'd tease him. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Today's the opening day of the Tribeca Film Festival, its 18th year of bringing people to Lower Manhattan and of being one of the things that that neighborhood of New York City is known for. Thanks in no small part to the woman whose office we kind of barged into last week.
Hi, I'm Kai. Nice to see you. How are you? Take a minute, finish your email if you want to. We kind of interrupted.
Jane Rosenthal is her name.
This is a great office. I love the idea of no desk and just a big dining room table, basically.
Because I work better at either the kitchen table or I work better in bed.
You and Winston Churchill.
Me and Winston Churchill.
And the work she's doing, wherever she's doing it, is of two different varieties. She's a film producer, with credits including Meet the Parents and Bohemian Rhapsody, to name just a couple. She is also the CEO and chairwoman of the company that puts on the Tribeca Film Festival that Rosenthal and her producing partner Robert De Niro started in the aftermath of September 11th, 2001, when not all that many people were going to downtown Manhattan. So I let her finish writing that email.
Those are great knickknacks. Is that Narendra Modi up there in the picture?
Yes.
Eventually.
Wow. And then the Wonder Woman comic book, which I love.
Yes, her real name is Jane. So we have, that's about all we have in common.
And then we settle in.
So this is going to air opening day of the festival. So my question to you is, a week out now, do you have time to be sitting here talking to me?
No, 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 not really. But you came to town, so always happy to welcome people to New York and Tribeca and talk about the festival. So thank you for having me.
Without making this all about you, right, and keeping the focus mostly on the festival, I do want to ask what it is about movies and films that do it for you. I mean, you've been doing this a long time, right? CBS and Disney, Warner Brothers, this partnership with De Niro for 30 years now, right?
Oh, God. I know, sorry. No, it's okay. I was only 12 when I started.
What is it, though, about this kind of product, if I could be really materialistic about it, that does it for you?
Well, I never picked a major. And I'm so curious or interested about so many different things. The one thing about movies, or now, you know, whether you're movies or television, but now we make content.
Yeah, right. Well, how do you feel about that word, by the way?
Content. I don't like it.
Yeah, I can tell.
I don't like that word. It is what it is, but I like to make stories, whether it's short form, long form, CD-ROM. I mean, I was one of the first to make a CD-ROM. That business didn't last too long, but
and yet you're still here.
But you get to explore different people, different parts of our culture, our society, different parts of history. You're always putting yourself in a different world.
I want to talk for just a quick second here. A film you're working on for Netflix with Scorsese and you and Bob De Niro called The Irishman, about Jimmy Hoffa. First of all, you've been working on this thing you've been trying to get it to the screen for 10 years?
Probably a little more. The first time I read I Hear You Paint Houses was 2007. It was research for a project that we were going to make with Marty and Bob called The Winter of Frankie Machine.
Mr. Scorsese and Mr. De Niro to me. Right. Anyway.
Okay, we were going to make this movie, and then it kind of stopped. It just it stalled.
So with the caveat that Netflix is your production partner in this film, what do you make of how they are disrupting the delivery of the material that you make? I mean, Roma and going to the big screen and the Oscars and the window of availability.
First of all, look at the fact that with Roma, a black and white film in Spanish,
mm-hmm,
that is on the tip of people's tongues. People are talking about Roma. That wouldn't happen if you had just put it in a limited platform release. You know, every so many years, the industry is disrupted. It was disrupted when you went from silent movies to talkies. It was disrupted when you went from black and white, mm-hmm, to color. I mean, it happens. It's just happening now at a faster pace. The other thing you have right now is the audience has never had more choice. And
right.
I think it's a very exciting time for creators.
So are you a CEO who's a film producer, or are you a film producer who's a CEO?
I'm a film producer that's a CEO. I think there are so many things that have happened to me along the way that were, you know, it's an unexpected part of my own journey. So spring of 2001, I had two little girls, and I was doing a movie in London about a boy, and I was doing a movie in L.A., and I was going London, New York, L.A., L.A., New York, London. I was picking up a kid. I was running back and forth. I was running into the office on 9/11 for a staff meeting, and then the world changed, and we said, okay, maybe we should do a film festival to give our neighborhood, our community, something to look forward to. I only believed that we were going to do that film festival once. I didn't realize. Here we are 18 years later. So I had to grow and learn, and a lot of it was on the job training, and, you know, buck stops here, so...
You've talked a lot about wanting to use this festival as a way to elevate female filmmakers and use it as a device to empower them to speak out, be heard, and do their good works. How do you think you're doing on that?
Yeah, I think we're doing great. We've always been doing this. Our company is 78% women. I wish we'd get to a point where we weren't having to say, oh, it's women filmmakers, it's this filmmaker. I wish we could just say filmmakers. I wish that we would no longer have to point it out as the exception. And, you know, I think we're at 48% women films in the festival. That said, it was at one point there was a question about should we pick this film because it's a woman or this film because it's better? And I'm just like, can you just pick the film that's better? I mean, I wish we would, and it's not going to happen for a while. The window is open for us as women, and we have a lot of work to do in terms of pay equality. So when does this all change?
Jane, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
We talked about a bunch of stuff. Jane Rosenthal and I did why she is bringing virtual reality and gaming into the film festival. Also, how Tribeca itself has changed in the 18 years that festival has been going on. You can hear all the rest of it on our Corner Office podcast. Coming up.
Fonts aren't free. In fact, there's big business around licensing typefaces.
Never ever take your favorite font for granted. But first, sure, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is off 59 points today, 0.2%, 26,597. The NASDAQ down 18 points, also 0.2%, 8102. The S&P 500 off 6 points. Yes, 0.2% again, 29 and 27. Boeing reported that its 737 MAX problems are going to cost the company at least $1 billion, but traders had already discounted Boeing's problems, so shares up more than 0.3%. They mentioned clothing retailer Lululemon is trying to encourage men to slip into something more comfortable. Lululemon stretched out 0.8%. Today, competitor Under Armour jumped 2%. Walmart has decided to go for a cut of the beef industry. The grocer says it plans to create a supply chain to bring no-hormone Angus beef products to some stores later this year. Walmart sizzled up 0.4%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. A how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The NFL draft starts tomorrow in Nashville, as made for television a sporting event as ever was created. But once you get past all the hype, teams do basically have their futures on the line. General managers have to figure out what and who they need and decide how much risk they can tolerate, trying to build a team that's balanced and has the right amount of upside. Sound familiar? It will to people who are attentive to the stock market. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
For every Super Bowl champion, future Hall of Famer Peyton Manning, there's one of these guys.
With the second choice in the draft, the San Diego Chargers select quarterback, Washington State University, Ryan Leaf.
Ryan Leaf. NFL Films ranked him the number one draft bust in history. For an investor, he's your pets.com.
There really is no such thing as a sure thing.
Cade Massey at the Wharton School is a consultant to some NFL teams, and he asks general managers to consider with every pick,
do you have the patience and the risk tolerance to wait another round, for example, until you think the price is right?
Patience, risk tolerance, the right price, words you might hear coming from any old investment advisor. They're hoping they can deliver big returns every year. So are NFL GMs. But not everyone is going to work out like Tom Brady, the 199th pick in the 2000 draft.
It's almost impossible to consistently outperform the market. This is something we've learned over time in the financial markets, but it turns out to be true in the NFL draft as well.
In other words, past performance is not indicative of future results. Jerry Notek sees similarities between his job and the NFL draft, too. He's a financial planner in Cleveland and a season ticket-holding Browns fan. He's watched the team rebuild for years.
This year's draft feels different.
That's because in last year's draft, the woeful Browns grabbed quarterback Baker Mayfield, who looks good so far. Notek wants to believe his Browns are one more good draft pick away from winning, but he thinks with his financial planner brain.
A lot of times, if you're investing for the long term, you greatly increase your probability of hitting your goals.
Now, there are plenty of ways in which the NFL draft is nothing like building a stock portfolio. You and your coworkers can own the same stock, probably do, but only one team can draft Oklahoma University quarterback Kyler Murray. Right up until draft time, teams will be trying to figure out if the 5'10" Heisman Trophy winner is a good investment. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Most of us, industrial and graphic designers aside, probably don't give fonts too much thought, unless it's something egregious like Comic Sans. But there are some go-tos in the world of typeface. Times New Roman, Arial, Calibri, also Helvetica. Helvetica is everywhere, but it has just come in for a redesign of sorts. Arial Partis wrote about it for Wired. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Do me a favor and place Helvetica in the font pantheon for me, would you?
Helvetica is one of the most popular fonts in the world. It makes up the branding material for companies like American Apparel and American Airlines. It's used in the New York City subway system. Our federal income tax forms are printed in Helvetica.
Wow, I had no idea, and I don't know how that makes me feel about Helvetica or our tax forms. okay, but apparently now they're in the transition to this digital age that we have been going through the past couple of decades. There are problems with Helvetica and getting it from typeset to screen.
That's exactly right. Helvetica was originally created in 1957 by a pair of Swiss designers, but then in 1982 it gets digitized for the first time. And there are some problems with that digitization. One of the problems here is that the font begins to look very scrunched up in small sizes. Some designers have called this Helvetica's micro-challenged characteristic. And so when you look at currencies, for example, like the pound sterling, they're really, really hard to read on smaller sizes. And that's a problem in our modern context as we're increasingly reading things on tiny, tiny screens, like, for example, the screen of an Apple Watch.
So how does this company that owns, I guess, the licensing rights, and I want to talk about making money off of Helvetica, but how does the company that owns these licensing rights, it's a company called Monotype, how do they go about fixing it?
Yeah, so Monotype has embarked on this long quest to redesign Helvetica for the modern age, and they've come up with a family of fonts that they call Helvetica Now, which are designed to work well in small sizes. But they've also introduced a new version of Helvetica that's designed to pop in larger sizes, and a version called Now Text, which is designed to be the sort of workforce for any context.
Tell me then how this company makes money, because, I mean, I guess it's intellectual property, right?
Yeah, well, fonts aren't free. In fact, there's big business around licensing typefaces, particularly to companies. And part of what's interesting about the story of Helvetica is that in the past 10 years, a lot of these companies have moved toward creating their own custom fonts. And part of that is to relieve some of the problems with Helvetica not showing up well on small screens or large screens. But part of it is also that it's just a cost-saving measure. IBM was reportedly spending over $1 million every year on licensing fees for Helvetica. So now that it has its own custom font, you know, that's potentially a big money-saving measure.
Sure. So to that business end of a thing, and, you know, companies spending money on licensing fonts, do you think this rebrand, this revitalization of Helvetica is going to work? Is it going to get, you know, companies back in the fold, as it were?
I think it remains to be seen. Part of the way that the designers at Monotype have described this facelift is very romantic. It's about getting people to fall back in love with Helvetica.
Wow.
But sort of like falling in love, it's something you can't force. We'll just have to see what happens.
True. Too true. So having done this research and written this piece now, do you have a favorite font? Do you tend toward Helvetica or the new one? I mean, what's your preference?
I think for the average person, the difference between the old Helvetica is perhaps not that discernible.
Well, yeah, but you didn't answer the question. Which one do you like best?
I think Helvetica now is pretty good.
All right. There you go. Ariel Pardes, she's a senior associate editor at Wired, writing about the new Helvetica font and the business of it, actually. Ariel, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
This final note on the way out today, one last, for us at least, look at tax season 2019. The Internal Revenue Service released its statistics for last week this afternoon, last week, of course, being the week that included the 15th of April. Despite all the hullabaloo over refunds early in the year, by actual tax day, just over 73% of households that filed returns got a refund, almost exactly the same percentage as a year ago. And while the average refund amount was down, wasn't down all that much, just 2%, again, over a year ago. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's down 59 today. The NASDAQ down 18 points today. The S&P 500 off 6 points, all of them 2% on the respective indices. 0.2%. Holy cow. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.